From the Sky News Centre at 5, the former British ambassador to the United Nations says he regards the invasion of Iraq as legal but questions its legitimacy. Sir Jeremy Greenstock also says the US seemed to be preparing for military action regardless of what the UK decided to do, and he thinks lessons can be learned.
It didn't have the democratically observable backing of a great majority of member states, or even perhaps of a majority of people inside the United Kingdom. So there was a failure to establish legitimacy.
The police officer killed during last week's flooding in Cumbria has been laid to rest. PC Bill Barker was swept away when the Northside Bridge in Workington collapsed beneath him. Chief Constable Craig Mackey paid this tribute after the funeral.
Today is all about Bill and his family. This is a very sad day. Cumbria Constabulary has lost a dedicated and committed officer.
Police are waiting to speak to a man in hospital in connection with the death of a woman in Canterbury. He was shot in the arm by officers after witnesses reported seeing a man with a gun in a supermarket. Administrators for the group behind Threshers have announced another 2,000 job losses. 391 more stores belonging to the Thirst Quench group will now close before Christmas. British tourists have contracted the E. coli bug after holidaying in the Spanish resort of Benidorm. The Health Protection Agency says 14 cases have been confirmed and four people have needed hospital treatment. England's cricketers have begun their run chase in the third one-day international with South Africa. The hosts made 354 for six in their 50 overs. England are currently on 28 for no wicket. And Ricky Whittle is free to compete on Strictly Come Dancing tomorrow. The favourite to win has spent the day in police custody, facing questions over an alleged overnight assault. But he's now been bailed. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Joining us live in the studio to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Labour Councillor for St George West and Chair of Bristol's Public Safety and Protection Committee, Ron Stone. Our regular Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, from 6, we'll be having a listen to Wall Street stockbroker Max Keiser's analysis of the week's financial news and Barack Obama's tour of Asia. We'll also be looking at one particular curious free event this weekend, which is tomorrow's annual craft fair and open day at Bristol Freemasons Hall. Plus, we'll be talking further to Ron Stone after 6. We'll be discussing this week's news in a moment, but first, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging around about 3 degrees Celsius, and it's drier on Saturday with a few sunny spells in the afternoon, cloudy on Sunday with some rain. Next week, averaging again down to 4 degrees, so it's a lot colder than the last few weeks. A cloudy week, although it's getting slightly warmer as the week progresses. Some sunny spells on Tuesday afternoon, the wettest day looking like Wednesday. Next weekend, that's the 5th and 6th of December, then we have averages up again, around about 11 degrees Celsius next weekend. Rainy on Saturday, though. That's the 5th and 6th of December. And that's the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from MetCheck.com. I'll also take this opportunity to tell you that there's very slow traffic on the M5 coming out of Bristol down towards Taunton. We're talking about speeds for about 10-15 miles of 38 miles per hour. So you may wish to consider taking a different route getting down. And I think it looks on the map here from the Highways Agency that the traffic is starting to flow more smoothly from the junction past Weston-super-Mare. So that's 38 miles an hour traffic down. I imagine that's due to the terrible weather. So on to our look at the week's news. And joining us in the studio this week is Councillor for St George, and that's St George West, is Ron Stone. Hi, Ron, and welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, good evening, everyone.
Now, tell us, have you always been a councillor, or what have you done in your previous life?
I've been a councillor for the city and the county of Avon for 24 years and always represented St George West. Before that, I was a trade union shop steward and member of what was then ASTMS's national structure for university technicians negotiations.
So what were you actually doing as part of your job when you were a shop steward?
To begin with, I was doing procurement for the university through its stores and apparatus purchases. And then I did the last 10, 12 years in doing health and safety for the physics department.
Now, you've got quite a big responsibility in the City Council. That is this Public Safety and Protection Committee, which sounds very grand. Can you tell us what your responsibility is as part of that role as the chair of that committee?
Yes. I mean, for many of the years, I chaired the Licensing Committee. I'm its vice chair this year because of the change of political control. But it's the other half of the enforcement and licensing structure, taxis, private hire, all the issues around street trading, any issues in relation to public safety and events, things like that.
Okay, and public safety and protection. So is it a committee that meets regularly? Is it quite often? You know, how often does it meet?
Yeah,
because I remember when the new licensing rules came in, that there were so many new licenses that needed to be reviewed. It was almost meeting every day for a couple of weeks. Did you?
Yes,
every day?
We did. And we got the record for the longest council meeting on one item, which was 13 hours.
Crikey. What was that item then?
It was an application for 24-hour opening in Henlees, and 52 members of the public turned up, all wanting to have their right under the law to have their say. We had to point out to them that if they did that and we actually exercised it to the letter of the law, we'd be there for 4.5 days and we all needed to go home. But there were, it was a major brewery chain that wanted to fight every line, dot and comma of the City Council's licensing policy, and we resisted every line, dot and comma, and the more they did it, the less they got.
Well, that's good to hear. You're prepared to stand up to the big boys on behalf of local residents. Okay, so anyway, can you tell us what you think of the overall system? This is something I ask many of the councillors that come in here, because over the last few years the system has changed from a situation where you've got all councillors potentially being involved in decisions to one where now those decisions are kind of now taken on by what's called the Cabinet. So can you just explain the system and then tell us what you think about it?
Yes, well, the new system apes Parliament, basically, in every way, shape or form. The Lord Mayor's the Speaker, the Cabinet of the City Council reflects the National Cabinet. The ability to study whatever is on the policy agenda is dealt with through the scrutiny structures. The problem with it is that, to me, local government isn't national government. It doesn't fit together very well. It tends to isolate councillors into specific areas of the City Council and having to work in those areas only.
But isn't that a good thing? Because, I mean, surely you've got, we've got, how many councillors have we got in Bristol?
70.
70 councillors. There must be some specialist interests and expertise amongst those councillors, so it makes sense for them to specialise a bit, doesn't it?
To a degree, but what it does mean is that the decision-making and the ability to get to know the full workings of the City Council, so that you as a local representative, when people come to your surgeries or phone you up, you've got knowledge of what the City Council's about, how it functions, what it's working, where it's going, etc., is lost. And also the ability to take critical decisions is being reduced to smaller and smaller numbers of people, whereas under the old committee structure, it would be made by a greater number of people with a greater amount of input and the ability to get, if you like, a more democratic decision, I think.
Now, the obvious question is, this all came in under a Labour government, didn't it? And so you can't really complain being a Labour councillor yourself.
No, what it came under a Labour government is totally true. I spoke in every opportunity against it, on the basis at the same time you'll find there's support for elected mayors, and I think that is the worst possible scenario you can have with so much power in the hands of one person.
So, yeah, what is it exactly that you've got against the idea of an elected mayor? Because several people have been floated over the last few years as potential mayors that, you know, may be embraced by the city.
Because you would have an even greater scrutiny structure you'd have to have, and that removes the elected representatives, councillors like myself, from being able to make and influence the main decisions the city council will be taking, because it would be down to one individual's agenda and how they perceived it, and I don't think that's democratic.
What you mean, like the sort of the King of Bristol?
Yeah.
Well, that sounds an interesting move. Okay. Now, we're also joined by our old Labour economics expert and political pundit, Martin Summers. Martin, we hear on the news today that we could be in something called a World Wide Web or WWW depression. What might that be?
I presume what they're referring to is the possibility that the economy will crash before it picks up again. Of course, it might not be a W. It might just crash and keep crashing. In other words,
this is referring to these graphs, is it?
These graphs, economic, yes.
Yeah, so it's going up and down, up and down, up and down, yeah. Kind of several times.
So obviously, with the collapse in Dubai yesterday, there's I haven't actually heard the financial news today, and they didn't mention it on the Sky News. So I imagine if it really had gone to town, we'd have been told. But of course, we're back teetering on the brink of collapse again, which is predictably the case. I mean, I'm not surprised at all.
Dubai is a long, long way away. It's not really that significant, though, is it?
Well, because everything's connected to everything else in the modern world, and you know, British banks are exposed to property collapse in Dubai. Lots of British people actually live over there. It's lots of expat Brits over there. It's, you know, it's just that there's plenty of other time bombs like this out there waiting to go off.
Yeah, but we can't be sitting here being nervous about every single country in the world of there and keeping an eye on their economy, because there may be problems with economies around the world every few days or every few months.
Well, I mean,
there are many countries out there.
What's happened as a result of the intervention by the US and British governments and European governments, but slightly retarded, has been that we've prevented a complete collapse. This time last year, we were looking at a complete collapse of the banking system. That is to say, banks closing their doors and just saying, all that money that we used to have inside here, it's gone. And they were absolutely staring down that barrel. Now, because governments have intervened and spent money like it's going out of fashion in all sorts of different ways, they've chopped everything except the kitchen sink at the problem. And as a result of that, we've managed to stabilise the situation briefly. But of course, what this has led to is a sense of complacency in the population at large that somehow the problem has been solved. And of course, it hasn't been solved. And what happened yesterday shows that it's still not resolved at all.
So, but banks still aren't really lending as much as people think they should be. The big question,
well,
I think, in many people's
private sector institutions.
Many, the question in many people's minds is, where has all this money gone? You know, there was you've got a stable economy. You know, before sort of 2 years ago or so, you've got a good stable economy and lots of money there floating around. You've also had all this money injected into it, and we're now being told that, you know, we may be possibly having problems in the future. The government have got to rescue the banks again, which they've done a couple of weeks ago. So where has all the money gone?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you've got to remember that it wasn't stable before it crashed. That's why it crashed, because it was unstable. And that we've been living on borrowed money, governments, individuals, companies, ever since the big bang in the city in the 80s, which the Tories brought in.
So is there some sort of big black hole out there?
Hole is the derivatives market, the shadow banking market, which is, nobody's really sure how big it is, but it's at least 10 times as big as what we can see on the surface. And all of that is actually worth nothing. Yeah, it was what the banks have been doing has been trading on assets which don't really exist. So they're absolutely bankrupt. And this is what nobody wants to face up to, which is that the private banking system basically is gone forever.
They can't be bankrupt now. We've bailed them all out.
Yes, they can. They can. But what they're doing is lying about what their assets are. When they say Barclays, for example, have claimed to make a profit, but that's because they're not marking to market their derivative trades. Their derivative trades are marked to imagination. You know, this piece of paper as it is worth so much.
It sounds
in
like
actual fact, it's not worth so much, and nobody's buying and selling these things because they all know they're worth nothing.
Sounds like
the obvious solution is to cancel those trades.
Sounds
of course,
like
nobody wants to do that.
Creative accounting?
Yes, well, it is. A lot of this is basically straightforward fraud. It's that bad. I mean, Elliot Spitzer used to be the regulator in New York, although he was bumped out with the call girl scandal. But he's saying a lot of what's going on here is outright fraud, and the problem is not that the rules don't exist against outright fraud, it's just that they've not been enforced.
Well, we've got
that's
some,
how bad it is.
We've got some stories we'll be talking about in the next half hour or so relating to all this, and also we've got Max Kaiser in the second half of the programme after six, who will be giving his take on the financial situation. Meanwhile, let's move on to look at some of the news stories, and we've got the Iraq inquiry, which is probably the big story of the last couple of weeks, opening. We're told today, as we just heard on the Sky News, that the war, according to Sir Jeremy Greenstock, was not legitimate. I don't know if you would like to start on this one, Ron, because if the war was not legitimate, and the Foreign Office was saying so at the time, how on earth did it get going back in 2003?
That's a deep question, isn't it, if ever there was one. I think the issue in relation to the Iraq war, clearly the initial decision to try to invade Iraq was based on American assumption with British support.
Now, hang on a minute, that's too easy just to blame the Americans, isn't it?
I know that. If you let me develop it a bit further. What I think at the time, there were suspicions which have proved to be unfounded in relation to what was available to Saddam and how that those weapons, if they existed, may have been used.
This is the famous WMD fraud,
yes,
really.
Exactly.
That never was.
Exactly. Now, the evidence that was presented, as I understand it, and I'm no international expert, was some very dubious so-called research in relation to whether this existed or not. And I was unhappy as a member of the Labour Party of the action that the government took, because I don't believe anything should have been done with Iraq until you had a total agreement or something passed that had the backing, full backing of the UN before you went in.
So was this a minority view in the Labour Party?
No.
So the Labour Party's not democratic then, is it?
It's getting more difficult, put it that way.
OK, Martin, do you want to come in on this one, the Iraq inquiry?
Well,
what's going on at the Foreign Office? If the Foreign Office has, it seems, nothing to do with important decisions about whether we're going to the war or not.
Well, I mean, what struck me about what's been said in the last couple of days by Jeremy Greenstock and Sir Christopher Meyer, who was the British ambassador to the UN, to the US, was that it was quite clear that the Americans had made up their mind to attack Iraq even before 9/11. And this is what we basically suspected on the ground anyway. I mean, most people didn't believe in the WMD story. Most Labour Party activists didn't believe in it at the time. Although and certainly MPs, were willing to go along with, oh, well, we were bamboozled. And that's what they're going to use this inquiry for now. Both Labour and Tory and Liberal, not so much the Liberals, because they did, in fact, vote against, to their credit, but Labour and Conservative MPs are going to use the inquiry to cover their backside, to say, ah, well, we were lied to by Blair. And if we'd known that there were no WMD, we wouldn't have voted in favour. Now, I think this is all very disingenuous. I mean, it's quite clear that we had a regime in the United States with a very, very, very strong questions about whether it's a legitimate regime or whether it's actually a regime based on electoral fraud. But let's just presume for a moment that it is a legitimate regime. But they still had a completely belligerent policy from day one. And what the Commonwealth were looking for Britain to do was to stand up to them. We were the only people in the world who had the political clout to stand up to them and say, look, you lot, stop it. We don't need any more provocations. We don't need you charging around the world invading places. Now, that's what a lot of Labour activists would have liked to have seen a Labour Prime Minister do. And if you say that's impossible, if you think back to the Vietnam War, Harold Wilson, a very moderate centrist Labour politician, but he would have nothing to do with sending British troops to Vietnam. And he was right. If the Tories had been in power, we'd have our own war memorials to Vietnam. Now, why can't we get back to that sense of our own national interest? What's happened here?
Well, I think you might be able to answer that, Ron, might you? As a Labour Party member yourself?
Yes. Well,
why didn't we stand up to them? I mean, you know, we can't be just persuaded, surely, cajoled, have our arms sort of twisted behind our backs to go along with something we don't agree with.
I think there was a crisis for Labour Party activists and members at the time, of obviously clearly supporting the party that he probably worked for years, against very deeply felt issues as has been outlined. And in many instances, those people actually resigned their party membership and worked in groups or activist groups outside of that against the Iraq war and the way it went on.
I remember also Robin Cook resigned his position on the cabinet, didn't he, as Foreign Secretary too. So I suppose there was a little bit of dissent. But, you know, ultimately, I think people are just simply disillusioned with politics as a result of something like this. Because, you know, why should anybody vote for a party when something like this goes on, where the majority of the party is saying, well, actually, we think we should stand back from this action and the invasion of Iraq, and yet the leadership of the party goes ahead with it anyway? This is quite scary, isn't it? And it yes. actually discredits the whole political system.
Well, I think there were other elements that were playing in this as well. The so-called special relationship between America and Britain, and how that propped itself up in relation to nuclear weapon protection, oil interests, trading interests, etc. So there was a number of other pressures in relation to apparently not breaking with America on the basis of this was going to be a problem, or perceived problem in Iraq. And it's been a problem for people like myself. I, for two elections, have seriously questioned, can I go out on the doorstep with a red rosette on and ask people to vote Labour? On the back of things like you've just outlined and other things that have gone on within the party, the issues in relation to the trade union movement and the loss of trade union rights and laws and other issues which are not on the agenda tonight. But it's the thing that's kept me in the Labour Party has been the fact that there are vulnerable people in St George West and in Bristol that genuinely need help, assistance and advice from people who have got a working class background, who do know how to get things done. And it is those people that, where I've been able to move things on for local families to get them rehoused or get help and assistance with children with disabilities and whatever, it's been those issues that have kept me thinking that I still have a role to play rather than the national issues.
Even if you're prepared to sort of turn around and find there's hardly anybody else in the party with you, you're still prepared to stick with it?
Yes.
Okay, let's anyway move on to the next story, which is the conspiracy of silence as the national newspapers ignore the News of the World's £800,000 payout. Now, this is a really peculiar story. We've had one of the biggest ever payouts for bullying. And the fact of the matter is that it's David Cameron's right-hand man that's been doing the bullying. But there's only one national newspaper, apparently, that has actually reported the story. It's The Guardian, and Roy Greenstade in The Guardian points out that the story appeared online on Monday night and in Tuesday morning's paper. It was covered by the Press Gazette, which is just a magazine only journalists get, and it was reported on a lawyer's website. There were also mentions of blogs, but the record payout, believed to be the largest award of its kind in the media ever, was not considered to be newsworthy enough for any national paper to mention. Yet it must surely be in the public interest for people to know about the misbehaviour by Britain's best-selling newspaper, that is, the News of the World, which is renowned for its own heavy-handed treatment of those it considers to have acted immorally. Similarly, since the editor said to have carried out the bullying is none other than Andy Coulson, now the communications chief for the Conservative Party leader David Cameron, there was a powerful secondary reason for the case to be reported as a matter of public interest. Now, when I saw this story yesterday, I thought it was going to be all over the newspapers today, but nothing. Now, this is quite surprising, isn't it? I suppose for people that don't know really who Andy Coulson is, he was the editor of the News of the World when this bullying took place. And he is now Cameron's right hand. He's a sort of Alistair Campbell figure for David Cameron and the Conservative Party. So what are your thoughts, Martin, on this story to begin with?
Well, the obvious thing that's very strange is the fact that the mainstream media haven't reported it. And that tends to suggest that we are in the run-up to an election campaign. Anything that's seen as embarrassing to the Conservative leadership is being basically not talked about. And presumably they just hope it's going to go away, and that nobody's going to pick up on this. Again, what is one surprise that these people are bullies? Not really. I mean, it's the kind of, you know, Alistair Campbell was for our side, was a pretty ferocious bully, and presumably they're trying to copy our bad behaviour.
I mean, one of the other things that's mentioned in Roy's article in The Guardian here is that ever since the Telegraph Media Group's owners, the Barclay brothers, withdrew their libel claim against The Times back in 2007, the two papers have not reported critically on each other at all. So it does seem that there's sort of truces going on around the national newspaper world. To be fair, the BBC on Radio 5 Live today did report this story. In fact, they actually had him on talking about some of his experiences and exactly how he was bullied and this kind of thing. But it sounds like a pretty serious case. I think he was a football reporter on the News of the World. Anyway, Ron, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm not surprised. You say it's surprising that the national media hasn't reported this. I'm not surprised at all, on the basis that the bulk of national media is in the hands of Tory party interests or interests other than the Labour Party. You've only got to look at the way in which they tiptoe around any of the issues that are sensitive for parties that aren't the Labour Party. If you go back to the expenses scandal, for example, I'm not defending the expenses issue one iota, don't get me wrong. And there are wrongs on every single party side in that issue. But the first 3 weeks of that campaign, the only issues that you heard about were brought to the attention or whatever, apart from the famous Duck Palace and moat, was all Labour Party. And there is a concerted campaign of virtually, I would say, of any government that's been in for three terms, if they're going for a fourth term, to knock them down and get them.
But that's not entirely fair, is it? Because you've got, I say you, as the Labour Party, you've got The Guardian as a generally Labour-supporting paper,
yes.
And you've also got the Daily Mirror. So, you know, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that there's still a conspiracy of silence, and there's still an issue around how, indeed, the news media interact with each other, I think, as well. I think the fact that this is one of David Cameron's most senior advisers is it particularly serious, and clearly this will have to be forced out into the open and made to run on the basis that this is one of the issues that is vital to people to know. This is how Tories will react. And this is what they try to control.
Well, the next story is actually another bit of embarrassment for David Cameron. It does seem like he's having a few problems with his with his spin doctoring this week, and that is a political row over school funding. This was at Prime Minister's Questions this week. A fierce political row over funding for schools with alleged links to Islamic extremists is raging on, with Children's Secretary Ed Balls accusing David Cameron of making false statements in the House of Commons. I don't know if you've followed this, but Mr. Balls has also accused Mr. Cameron of making divisive smears, saying that the cash going to the schools in Slough and the North London borough of Haringey was in fact intended to fund free nursery places for 3 and 4 year olds, and that's since proved to be false. So, Martin, would you want to just comment on this in relation a bit maybe to the previous story? Is David Cameron losing it?
Well, I think he's. It makes me laugh, ha ha ha, because this whole thing of having faith-based schools was originally pushed through by the Conservatives and has been picked up by New Labour. And, of course, my parents were both comprehensive school teachers. My father was a comprehensive school headmaster for 25 years. And of course, faith-based schools, I mean, that's what a lot of the problems in Northern Ireland came about, because you've got faith-based schools. And we've actually got ourselves into a mess here. I mean, I don't think that Islamic groups should be allowed to have schools any more than Jewish groups or Roman Catholic groups. But if you're going to have the, if Roman Catholic groups are going to be able to have their own schools, and Jewish groups are going to be able to have their own schools, and so have Islamic groups have got to have their own schools. And of course, the fact that some of these people might be related to Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is actually a pacifist organisation, whatever else you might say about their views, which are frankly bonkers, I think Cameron is playing for the racist vote here, but he just hasn't got his facts right. And I think that's typical of the slapdash way he approaches things, frankly.
Ron?
Well, it's, again, typical of what we've seen, I think, over the last 18 months, and that is that the Tory position is all spin, promise or hype, but there is no depth or content in what they say, and there's very little truth, and that the real truths are being hidden. And I think the recent or last opinion poll, it shows the gap is narrowed between the major political parties. I think people are starting to ask questions in relation to who they would vote for and what they would get, and they're starting to realise that the Tory party is about spin. And when you look at what they're saying, there are huge inaccuracies or things, large holes in what they're promising, with no means of being able to actually deliver.
I think the thing that worries me most about this story is the fact that it is, as Ed Ball says here, such a divisive smear, because the implication is here that there's some kind of schools in these parts of London are some kind of terrorist training camp. This is rather scary, isn't it?
I can imagine the parents and teachers of these schools being very, very angry about being put in that category, and rightly so. I mean, we're trying to build unity in the community against terrorism, against extremism, and this isn't the way to do it, is it?
Okay, moving on to the next story. Thousands of children may have had swine flu without even knowing. This is from the Daily Mail a couple of days ago. And, I mean, we've been covering the swine flu story on here really since the spring, and being rather sceptical about it. We're now told that there's very unlikely to be any kind of really serious pandemic now, and that a lot of youngsters, and of course adults too, it looks like, may have had been, that the swine flu may have been such a mild cold or flu that they may have had it without even realising. Now, the question this arises in my mind is, we as a country have paid for two doses of the Tamiflu drugs for every single person in Britain off the back of this pandemic announcement by the World Health Organization, and it seems to me that we've also paid for this virus injection. So it's almost like this whole swine flu thing has been some kind of phantom. Ron, can you just give us your take on this? Why on earth and how on earth has such a mistake been made? Because this seems to be a little bit more than just they're being cautious. It seems to be really quite a big mistake.
Well, it seems to me that this again is almost part of the psyche now of modern society, that whatever is the latest threat then becomes the latest pandemic. But where is the evidence? And indeed, it's almost the nanny state gone bananas.
But you mean the Labour Party created the nanny state, didn't they? They created the welfare state.
Yes, they did. But I think that, some of the issues now, where it's gone and how far it's gone, I think it's ridiculous.
We had Ian Crane on here 2 weeks ago talking about this, and he was just explaining how quite a lot of the pharmaceutical industry actually has got its own people onto these government advisory committees. So, as a Labour person, can you explain that? Why have you allowed the pharmaceutical industry to be taking a hand in making these very important, what should be, independent decisions?
Well, they should be independent, and I'm sorry to hear that they've got influence on it, because it's like me and poacher and gamekeeper, isn't it? And I wouldn't want to see that spread, or indeed I would speak against it. What I think in this is that every winter we get flu epidemics. Some things are accredited and different strains do appear. And I'm not saying for one minute that there shouldn't be a national vaccine programme. But I think the extent to which this took off before there was any real benefit or evidence proven for it, and the amount of money and what it could mean, I think it's disgraceful.
Martin?
Well, as I've said in previous weeks, Tony, I'm loath to comment on medical stories, in the sense that I'd like to be able to refer to people who actually know whether there is a threat, because I haven't got the expertise to know.
Have you had the swine flu? Have you had the jab?
I don't know. I've been sniffling today, so maybe I've had it, because that's what it looks like from this story. I might have had it without even knowing it. I am very aware of the economic background to the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, they hold things like the National Health Service to ransom. And, of course, developing countries have had a continuing gripe with the pharmaceutical companies about patents. You know, they're not allowed to produce their own generic versions of drugs, which, of course, there's plenty of drugs for malaria and so they can be produced at one peer shot, but they can't do that because they've got to use the patents that the pharmaceutical industry have built up. And I think the National Health Service has been undermined partly by PFI and things like that, and the kind of, the internal market and all that stuff.
This is a sort of privatisation.
Yes, a creeping privatisation. But the other way in which the National Health Service is snookered is because it has to buy all of its drugs from the private sector. And I would suggest that there is a very strong case for putting the whole of medical stuff, you know, production of drugs, decisions about whether to deploy them, all the rest of it, outside the market, full stop. Yeah, just have nationalised business doing that business. Well, it's about people's health. It's not actually a business. I mean, look at all the mess they're getting into in the US now with Obama's half-cocked health plan, which is just another version of private healthcare with a bit of subsidy thrown in. And it's just a joke. I mean, we've got to get back to first principles. The British National Health Service is probably the most efficient system in the world for providing healthcare for people, precisely because it's free, precisely because it's taken completely out of the market. And that's actually the principle that we ought to go back to.
Yeah.
Ron, I'll give you the final word on this one, though. What about you and your constituents or people you represent? Have you had the swine flu yourself?
No, not to my knowledge. If I have, it's a bit like other people. One or two people I know have reacted or appear to have bad flu attacks, but whether it's swine flu or not, I've no idea.
Yeah, so I think this is one of the big problems with this, isn't it? It seems to be a sort of vague thing floating around. No one's really quite sure whether they've got it, whether they should take the pill, and this is no way to do government.
No, and it's no reason to go out, rush off and have a vaccination either, in my view.
Okay, now we're going to have a look at zoom in on one particular story, and that is to do with the press. And I'm joined by Marina Morris. Hi, Marina.
Hello.
We're going to have a little listen to your report, and then you've been out on the streets again, so we're going to have a vox pop after that. So let's just start off with your report on the media.
Mm-hmm. This week I have looking at national newspapers. The media has great powers to influence how we all think and perhaps even vote. Media takes truth information, communicates knowledge, values and beliefs to its readers. To quote Spider-Man's uncle, this great power comes great responsibility. The Guardian recently introduced a number of false stories about celebrities into its competitors' news stream and sat back to watch the result. This demonstrated the unreliability and falling standards of the newspaper media. The results are contained in the film Star Suckers. Some of the Fleet Street's top newsrooms, including those of The Sun, Daily Mirror, Daily Star and Daily Express, were fooled by the hawks. If the story were properly sourced and verified, they would not have been published, but filtered out. However, the fake stories were published and subsequently repeated across the internet. What is going on? Celebrities need the oxygen of publicity and are unlikely to complain too loudly when the publicity does not harm them. Advertising revenue for the newspapers has fallen drastically, and newspaper sales are also falling. The papers have responded to these large-scale redundancies, but have still the same amount of daily copy to fill. Other media, in particular television, are filling all ever more of our news needs. Is it any wonder that journalistic standards appear to be falling? The Guardian has published figures for the daily average circulation on its own website. The Guardian shows increasing newspaper sales comparing September 2008 and September 2009, but only because the paper reversed the column of its data, which it miscopies from ABC, the source of the industry standard statistic. Its sales are actually falling. It is perhaps a motive to group paper together, but if for sake of generating overall statistic, we call Group A the Sun, Mirror, Star, Record, Mail and Express, and Group B, The Guardian, Telegraph, Times, Financial Times and Telegraph. Group A's circulation in this period was dropped from nearly 8.7 million to 8.5 million. Group B circulation has similarly fallen by about 0.2 million, but from nearly 2.5 million to 2.3 million. Overall, this represents the proportion of the population buying a daily paper, falling from 18.6% to 17.9% in a year. We are buying less papers, and those that we do buy are generally the cheaper ones. The largest drop in newspaper circulation was the Independent, falling by 15.6% in a year. On the main dailies, comparing September 2008 and September 2009, only the Daily Star increased its circulation, but perhaps it was more due to its price, 20 pence, now 25 pence. When it started in 1970, the Sun's editor must have thought page 3 looked pretty, fresh and wicked, a challenge to the establishment Britain. But perhaps it is a relic of another Britain, Britain of naughty postcards and carry-on films. Is the Star taking the baton on the Sun to the people of Britain? Is this the news that we want to read? What do the people of Bristol think about newspapers today?
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Facts are, and headlines do not always mean the truth.
What do you think about page 3 girls in the newspaper?
They're not on page 3 of the Times, to my knowledge, so... I don't really know, to be honest. I don't really have too much of an opinion on it either way. It's sort of not a paper I buy, so I guess I'm not really supporting it. But sort of whether it's degrading to a woman or not, which I guess would be the most important question, I wouldn't really know.
I think it's just stupid. if they want to pose, well, you know, they want to pose, and that's fine by me, but it seems a bit tacky. I don't hold an opinion, really.
No, it's if they want to pay good money for that, well, I suppose that's their... You know, up to them, but I wouldn't buy a newspaper for that.
Oh, they're attractive, aren't they, beautiful women? I think on the whole it's acceptable, it will cheer you up, bring a smile to everybody's face. I can see that, but women have got great virtues, great brains, and they are attractive to look at, so I don't think they should feel worried by it. We appreciate them in all their aspects.
Well, it's a part of an art form with English papers, especially for the Sun. It's a very interesting topic. I've got no problems with it, apart from perhaps... Well, I don't really know, actually. That's about as much as I can say on that. I think it's down to the individual person. Obviously, other people's views, you can take that into account. I think it's down to the person that's actually doing the work. I mean, they have a choice.
Paper I buy, I haven't got them. Bit of harmless fun. That's it.
No, not really, no. Not for me. If it's done willingly, but I don't really think that in this 21st century that it should be necessary.
I think that if that is the thing that is part of life, that's part of life. If you tell me that somebody will walk down the street and say, that's not a pretty girl, then I'm sorry, but that is not a fact of life. As long as it is not over the top, and as long as it is not total nudism, what is the problem? In the rest of Europe, we think about things slightly differently. In northern Germany, naturism is a normal subject. So what is the problem?
Well, that does relate to that earlier story we had about the News of the World, doesn't it? Because they're one of the most notorious papers that has this tactic of having a semi-naked woman on page 3. Martin, what are your thoughts on semi-naked women on page 3? Would you buy a newspaper because it had one, or do you have any objections to it, or what?
Well, I certainly wouldn't buy a newspaper because it's got semi-naked women in it. I think it's very hard to say people can't take such photographs or look at them if they want to. What makes me laugh is that on page 3 you'll find that these girls all have very, very convenient opinions. You know, Shelley from Essex happens to think that David Cameron is the man for her, for example, and these are patently not their real opinions. These are opinions that have been pasted in.
Well, it's just having a bit of fun, surely.
But no, but I mean, that's the point, isn't it? If it was just a bit of fun, then the political opinion would be left out. And this is what's pernicious about it, is that it's what... the pop star or rock star Brian Eno calls proper gender. Not propaganda, proper gender.
What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that people have only got so much energy in a day to take in information, haven't they? And if they spend most of their day taking in trivial, pointless information, then the important stuff about how the economy's collapsing, how there may be a third world war, might miss their attention. And of course, there's plenty of distraction. That's what goes on all the time. People are being distracted.
But I'm not sure. I think the Sun is the best-selling newspaper in the country. That is the choice of the people. that so, read it.
And in actual fact, there's lots of it's always been a until it changed to supporting New Labour. It was a Tory paper, but lots and lots of Sun voters were Labour voters. So there's an element of it just being water off a duck's back. People read this political stuff every day, but they just throw it in the waste paper basket and vote Labour anyway. I don't want to make judgments about people's having fun, but life isn't just about having fun. You need to inform yourself as well.
Ron, are you someone that reads these the Sun and has a look at the girl on page 3 or what?
Well, I being a politician, you read all manner of papers. Sun's one, and now it's changed its allegiance. Certainly, you need to look at it.
So you don't like looking at the girl on page 3. Now it's changed its allegiance.
Well, it's there, but I think it's an outmoded concept now. I think it's gone past its sell-by date.
Well, it hasn't, because it's clearly the best-selling newspaper in the country still.
It's not necessarily the girls that are selling it.
But you haven't got the proof to say that it's that, and it. I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was a debate somewhere with some of the girls that actually pose on the paper. And it was generally felt that it was rapidly coming to the end of its life as the real issue in the paper.
Well, I would say if I was one of the managers of The Sun and I was looking at increasing circulation, it seems like one of the things that does actually persuade people to buy it. Because even if it is just that they turn to page 3 and they see a picture of a woman who's got some sort of intricate political opinion, it does make you laugh. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes people buy newspapers.
Well, I think the other thing is where do you stop with it? Because there's other papers like the Sunday Sport and all these other papers where there's page after page of this sort of thing. But if you look at the news content of that, you know, they're reporting that there's a super fortress on the moon and Elvis is alive and living in Easton. You know, I mean, how much can you believe in what they're doing? So the level of journalism in the paper is rock bottom. I think it's down to people's interests or whatever. If people want to do that and the girls are happy to do it and they're paid well, fair enough. The other thing is how far do you take, naked pictures, nudism or whatever you want to call it, in relation to some of the charity earners that go on? Because look how many issues that you've had of charity calendars with tasteful pictures, if you like, but based on the same concept. So I think there's some issue there that is defensible. It's a question of whether how you react to it yourself.
I'm interested in this concept of proper gender, Martin. I just wondered if you could explain it to us again a little bit more. What is going on there?
Well, I think when Brian Eno first mentioned this phrase, it was in relation to the run-up to the Iraq War. And he was saying, we've spent a whole year talking about whether Saddam Hussein's a bad man, how bad is he, how bad does he have to get, does he have weapons of mass destruction? And he said, at the same time, we've got so many million people dying of HIV, so many million people dying of starvation, so many, you know, all the real issues which never get discussed. Yeah. And I think we spend a lot of our time, we're getting infotainment more and more, where people are not actually, I mean, in the Second World War, for example, people would be switching on the radio 9 o'clock to listen to the BBC to get news about what was happening. Yeah? And they were hungry for news to know what was going on, what had happened at Stalingrad that day or whatever. People need to get back to that sense of what newspapers are for. They're not just, I mean, if people want to have read something for fun, then that's a different thing, but that's not a newspaper.
Isn't it partly because so much of the news is so bad that it depresses people?
Yes.
And actually, what they want is a laugh.
That's fair enough.
Can I make a comment on that? One of the difficulties you find as a local politician is good news stories aren't news, bad news stories or...
Can you give us an example?
Well, for example, we got a new play area in St George Park. It opened up. It got some coverage, but not a lot. That was an £83,000 investment in local children's play. But the local media be far more interested in the fact that somebody is complaining to the city council that they've been badly treated because something has not happened correctly in their service or whatever. So it's 84-year-old widow being picked on by an evil city council. That gets the front page. But the play area and a major difference for local children in Bristol East gets very little coverage
at
all.
Well, I guess that's down to the editor of the Evening Post and various other places. Anyway, let's move on away from the tabloid press and on to something a bit more serious, which is one of the big financial stories of the week. The banks could charge £2.50 every time we use a cash machine. This was really in relation to the Supreme Court, which is something it seems a bit weird saying in relation to Britain, because we think of the Supreme Court as being an American thing, but now we apparently have one here in Britain. And the Supreme Court in the UK, which I suppose used to be the House of Lords, but it's now been taken over, is saying that rather than having to pay this £2.50 every time we use a cash machine, we're just going to have to live with our old overdraft charges. Now, another headline in the Telegraph tells us that the overdraft ruling by the Supreme Court earlier this week has saved the banks £2 billion. And obviously that's going to be good because they're going to be able to lend that money out to us and to businesses to help get us out of recession. And we also hear that the OFT bank charges investigation was derailed by the Supreme Court ruling. So that means the Office of Fair Trading have put something like 2 years' work. In fact, yes, it is a two-year fight to investigate overdraft charges, and it's all come to nothing. Now, this is not really going to be very good news at the Office of Fair Trading, Ron, is it?
No, it's not. And I think it reflects back on the previous conversation we had in relation to banking and banking as an industry. I had a case of a local pensioner who normally had his pension paid into the post office, but when the post office closed, had to go to one of the local banks. And the local banks were actually charging him for withdrawing his pension. And basically they were taxing him on his pension for drawing his own money. And that was so unfair that I had to go to the local bank with him and sit down and get the manager to write it off. Now, the rip-off charges, I think this is part of a whole set of rip-off charges that banks do to local people. I think it's absolutely outrageous what they charge you if you go 56p overdrawn and you get a £25 letter sent to you telling you that you are so. I think that's outrageous. I think it's outrageous that if you pay money in to your bank account and then go to the hole in the wall and get a statement, it's there immediately. You sign a check and they tell you it takes 4 or 5 days. Why does it do that? It's because they keep your money and they use that money in that period of time and they rip you off. And so the whole of the banking structure needs a complete overhaul. And I think the banks are getting away with absolute murder on this sort of thing, on the backs of ordinary working people that are genuinely trying to use the banks, but the charges they make are outrageous.
So what's your lovely Labour government going to be doing about this in the run-up to the next general election? Otherwise, you're not going to get back in, are you?
Well, I don't know whether we'll get back in or not.
Well, if you can't do something about the financial crisis and the banks, then surely, you know, someone else is going to come along. It's either going to be a Liberal government or a Conservative government.
Well, apart from the international structure that we debated before and the support that the British taxpayers given banks up to now, I think the whole operation of banks needs to be looked at as part of that structure by any new government.
Yeah, well, time is ticking, isn't it? Time's ticking. You need to get this looked at straight away. Martin, can I just have your thoughts on this particular story about the Supreme Court decision and what you think of the Supreme Court and what you think of their decision?
Well, I think it's plainly the wrong decision, and it's not going to be a very popular decision either. And I understand that the government, Gordon Brown yesterday was saying that legislation will have to be brought forward to discipline the banks. I think he's starting to talk the talk that he needs to start talking if he wants to be Prime Minister next year. But I mean, the fact is that the whole establishment here, the political establishment right across the board, apart from a few lone voices, have bought into this idea that the banks were infallible, that the City of London knew what it was doing and all the rest of it. And they were absolutely stunned and shocked when the crash happened 2 years ago. And I just think, I mean, I'm really disappointed in somebody like Gordon Brown, who is actually, you know, he used to be well thought of in academic socialist economic circles, you know, the Red Papers for Scotland and so on, which he wrote when he was at university. I mean, these people seem to have lost any sense of actually researching what the hell actually really goes on. They've just bought hook, line and sinker the efficient market hypothesis that they don't have to bother with what the banks get up to. The banks managing what they do. And there was a kind of devil's bargain between New Labour and the banks. The City of London was booming on the back of all this deregulation. They were paying a lot of money into the Exchequer, which allowed expansion of spending on the health service and so on. And as long as that was going on, nobody wanted to ask any questions. But the whole thing really does need to be overhauled. And I think that what people have got to realise is we're not going back to private banking. The banking system all over the world now is effectively in the hands of the government, directly or indirectly. But nobody wants to actually face up to the fact and say, well, what do we want them to do?
But it's not totally in the hands of the government, is it? Because it's a sort of wrestling match going on. It's a grappling match.
What the government, in fact, owns directly or indirectly the whole banking system all over the world, but they're not actually exercising the power of ownership. Like British government doesn't actually have people on the board of RBS, for example. It's just ridiculous. We've basically handed the money over and said, well, you sort yourselves out.
You've led us beautifully on to another story here. Fury, as a credit crunch civil servant, lands Rothschild job. The civil servant who oversaw the taxpayer's stake in Britain's crisis-hit banks is at the centre of a conflict of interest row after it emerged he's to join a leading investment bank. Now, this is the chap who was supposed to be looking after the public's interests. His name's John Kingman, the former chief executive of UK Financial Investments, and he's going to become the new managing director of a private bank, N.M. Rothschild. Now, Martin, I think you know this. You're probably best to start with you on this. Is there really some conflict of interest here, or is this just a natural move from someone who's running the banking sector from the public's point of view as a public appointee, and then suddenly switching over to become one of Mr. Rothschild's managing directors?
Well, I mean, Kingman was brought in to run the UK Financial Investments precisely because they didn't have anybody to do it. So they're making policy on the hoof. Yeah, so UK Financial Investments is the mechanism by which the government wants to try and exert some control over the banks, and then you've got to employ somebody, and the likelihood is you want to go for somebody with some experience of how the banking system works. But of course, this revolving door between the private and the public sector, between the people who are regulating and the people who are supposed to be being regulated, really has to be looked
at. So why do we need UK Financial Investments Limited? Why can't it just be the Treasury running this? Why do we need a separate company?
Because they're trying to do this whole stuff at arm's length. Yeah, this is the whole idea, is that the government, in fact, I mean, doesn't know what's going on. We don't want to know, because we're actually trying to recreate the private banking system. Now, this is the fallacy at the heart of all the policy that's being pursued. A Labour government, above all, should realise that we've reached the end of the line for private banking. We've actually got to create a credit system which is actually public. Credit should be provided like water, like electricity, like transport, as a public utility. Now, of course, nobody in the City of London wants to hear that.
Those aren't really public utilities anymore. They've been privatised.
No, I know, but that there's another question that needs to be answered there. But the financial system has effectively nationalised itself. Now, what we have got is politicians who don't have the get up and go to actually assert control over the situation. They're allowing the private banks and their shareholders, which basically we're talking about the wealthy classes here, they're dictating what's going to happen. Now, this is no good. If we say, where's the money gone earlier? The money has gone into the pockets of wealthy speculators and investors. The top 10% of the population all over the world have done very, very well out of this bubble. Very well. Most of them are, at least literally, they started off as millionaires, they are now billionaires. And if somebody has to pay for the crisis, to patch up the public services, to get us through the Green New Deal that we need and all the rest of it, who's going to have to pay for that? It's going to have to be them. And that's got to be talked about openly for the first time in a generation. Yep. We've got to start redistributing wealth. That's what we've got to do.
Ron, are you a Daily Mail reader? Because this is a Daily Mail story. Are you angry that this chap who was running the government's investment in the banking sector is now the managing director of N.M. Rothschild, the private investment bank?
Well, naturally, it must open questions in relation to confidentiality and, if you like, the ability to insider trade or indeed to use information that may have been confidential.
Can he have split loyalties? I mean, if he's doing that job for the public, can he then go and do it for a private firm like Rothschild?
I don't think so, but you can see why he's done it, because apparently the job that he resigned from, he was getting £143,000 a year, and it's estimated he's going to earn £1 million very quickly. I can understand what his motives might have been, mainly. He's gone, obviously, chase a fat salary. But I think the whole issue of banking and indeed the stake that all of us have had, the people in my ward and what they've had to pay to prop up the banking system, whilst I totally agree that something had to be done because we were into total meltdown, I think individuals like this and some of the questions that have gone on now in relation to still paying the large expenses, etc., to people.
Okay, that's all we've got time for the time being. We're just coming up to the Sky News at 6 o'clock, and then afterwards we'll be having more discussion with Ron Stone, Labour councillor for St George West.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.